Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Do you remember? On my desk, there's a blue medicine container that has seven sections. It's a plastic thing. It's on the desk. Could you bring it? Let's read the same paragraph from yesterday, and then the terms are defined in the following paragraphs. Tachavakyam Mahavakyanurgatam Mahavakyam cha vakya samudayah asyartas tu pakram opasamharadi bir eva avadaryate tatahi upakram opasamharav abhyaso purvita palam artavahadopapati cha lingam tatparya nirnaye. Sorry. What is all this stuff? Excuse me just for a second. A sentence, moreover, belongs to a Mahavakya. A Mahavakya is a group of sentences whose meaning is ascertained according to its beginning, conclusion, and so on. As it is said, the signs used to determine overall meaning are beginning and conclusion, repetition, novelty, result, praise, and logical reason. Okay, we'll define these. Hold on for a few minutes. I think I have a doubt here about one sentence. The way I have it phrased, that in order to be a Mahavakya, it has to have its meaning ascertained by these six signs. And that a sentence, a group of sentences that doesn't have its meaning is not a Mahavakya. That's a mistake. Let me make a note of it. All right. Then we continue. Upakrama upasamhara yor ekarupatvam panau punyam anarigatatvam palam prayojanam prashamsa yuktimatvam cheti shadvidani tatparya lingani. Okay. The six signs that indicate overall meaning are beginning and conclusion, which count as one, because you should have both of them. Something to be a good candidate for the main topic should be mentioned at the beginning and the end. So we both of them together make the sign. And then repetition, which is here, instead of saying abhyasa, Jiva-sami is glossing it as paunak punyam, or repetition, being said over and over again. Anadigattatvam, the fact of being unknown before. Well, that's novelty. Let me just match them up with the terms used in the verse, and here we're getting the glosses. So repetition is defined as repetition. Well, okay. Let me fix that. That's not much of a significant gloss to gloss repetition as repetition. In other words, I should translate paunak punyam more literally to make the sentence mean something. And then the fact of being unknown. Well, that's novelty. The fact of being unknown before. Just like it's announced somewhere, you know, you may not know it, but Krishna is the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So to a certain audience, that's something novel, unknown before. If such a statement of something unknown before is made, it's a very good candidate for the main topic of the whole passage. And then prashamsa, oh, I'm sorry, the fruit or purpose. Palam is the word in the verse, yeah, purvita palam. Apurvita is glossed as anadigatatvam. And then palam is restated here, and its gloss is prayojanam, fruit or purpose. Fruit doesn't mean apples and bananas, here it means purpose. Then prashamsa, which in the verse was artavada, which is being glossed here as praise. We were reading before how there's different kinds of artavada, but basically they're just praising the topic. When the topic, when an idea gets, something gets praised, it's also a good candidate for the main topic. And then yukti matvam, logical support. Upapati is the word in that verse. So it's glossed as yukti matvam. And somewhere used in a different context, yukti matvam can mean reasonable, having logic. But here it means being supplied with a logical argument. You actually make a specific statement of some logical argument. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because all the other devatas have to work hard and he's just playing. A reason is given. So giving a reason makes something, a reason about something makes that something a good candidate for the main topic. And if I remember right, there's a hierarchy of weight, of importance. I think the first ones, the ones listed first, are more important than the among the six. So, the ones that are listed first are more important than the ones listed after. If you've got contrary indications, then the upakrama and upasamhara have priority over all the other signs, and so on. Evam? Okay. And thus, those are the six signs that indicate overall meaning, or the tatparya lingani. So here we're translating tatparya as overall meaning. Elsewhere we translate it as the intention of the author. But it means both. Okay, then continuing. Evam anvaya vyatireka bhyam gati samanyenapi mahavakyarto vagantavya. Thus, the meaning of a Mahavakya can be understood by positive and negative comparison and by equivalence of meaning. I'm not sure what the relevance of that is. When we apply these six lingas, are we using negative and positive comparison? I'm not sure what's being talked about in that sentence. Maybe it's explained in the commentary. Let me just put it aside, unless someone else understands what it means. Let me just put it aside until we get to the commentary. Atra yukti matvam nama nashushka tarkana grid hitatvam kintu tat shastroditam katanchit sambhavana matram lakshanam shastra vayartya prasangadeva. Here, logical support, which is the last of the six lingas, upapati or yukti matvam, logical support does not mean being graced by dry speculation. Rather, it is simply the characteristic of being able to somehow give an explanation of what is stated in a particular scripture. Otherwise, we would have to conclude that the scripture serves no purpose. Now, there's nothing in the commentary to explain that sentence. The meaning of a Mahavakya can be understood by positive and negative comparison and by equivalence of meaning. I have to think about that. Anybody have an idea? What does it have to do with the six signs? Actually, it just says anvyavratireka, negative and positive something. Well, usually in logic it means, like in Udaharanam, wherever there's fire, there is smoke. Wherever there's smoke, there is fire, like in the kitchen, and unlike in the middle of the lake. Those are negative and positive examples. They involve comparison. This mountain is like the kitchen. It's not like the lake. That's negative and positive comparison. I don't know how that applies here. Yes? You see something? Okay, I'll leave it marked and we'll see. Okay. I'll read the commentary and then we'll see if there's an explanation later on. Commentary, an extended passage of a text may discuss several different themes, thus causing difficulty in judging what the main theme of the passage is. The method of deciding by these six signs is provided for resolving such doubts. If an idea is mentioned both at the beginning and the end of the passage, that idea is likely to be the central theme. Again, the idea is likely to be the central theme if it is mentioned repeatedly, if it is introduced as new information not revealed before, if knowing or executing the idea is said to lead to a special result, if the idea is highly praised, and if a logical argument is presented to establish its importance. Srila Jiva Goswami uses this method several times in the Sandarbhas. For example, near the end of the Sri Paramatma Sandarbha 105, where he demonstrates the Bhagavatam's principal theme. Okay. No, I don't think the following paragraphs change to a different topic. Yes. I guess there's some way in which the application of these six signs or the finding them involves negative and positive comparisons and equivalence of meaning. That's gati samanya.
Because you use these six to understand what is the Mahavakya.
Yes.
So you compare, okay, this thing is being repeated. Yes, but it doesn't come from at the beginning and the end. This is not mentioned.
No, it's not that. See, no. It's not that you have to have all six signs.
Isn't there a competition in between the signs?
You mean between the signs?
In between
the
signs?
Well, but that is discussed in the Mimamsa Shastra, but it hasn't been mentioned by Jiva Goswami. Why does he say thus?
Because many things may be
stated he didn't,
at the
he
beginning.
Didn't talk,
and,
Jiva Goswami hasn't said anything about which of these six signs is more important than the next. What do you do when you have an apparent conflict among the signs? He hasn't discussed that. So he hasn't discussed comparing the effect of one sign with another.
But, I mean, something can be said at the beginning. Many things can be said at the beginning and the end. Okay.
Yes.
There's many things said at the beginning and end. Okay, so let's see what's repeated throughout the text. Okay, well, let's see if there's any fruits or any glorification. So you compare all the different things that are said by using this, and then you get your... get the understanding of the meaning of the Mahavakya
more or less
is understood by positive and negative comparison of these different signs, in the equivalence of the meaning of these different
signs. What equivalence of meaning? Gati Samanya. That's what, that term is used in the Vedanta Sutra to mean having the same meaning or the same purpose. I'm sorry, what you said is basically right, but I have to pin it down a little more exactly. I have to think about it. Exactly how that applies. Yes.
Last one of the six is the logical support.
Yes.
So is this had to do with something with the logical analysis that we see that this positive and negative comparisons and equivalence of meanings?
No, it's just another sign. It's not something that you apply all the time. You know, this last sentence is saying this is something we do in general. Whereas Upapadi is just another, and it's not you, the analyst, who applies it. It's that in the text itself, the text presents a reason. When the text tells you a reason for something, that makes that something important. You're talking about when we use our reason to sort things out and looking at the text. But we're talking, the six signs are things you should find in the text. The giving of a reason should be right in the text. Okay? So our using positive and negative comparison, that's a different thing. We, the readers, use our logic. But we're talking about the logical statements in the text itself. They're signs. They're the six of the six signs. Okay? Yeah. Yes.
Just maybe a suggestion. I don't know if it's right.
Even. Well, let's try it.
But you know, the meaning of the Mahavakya is understood by, you know, you can, if these things, by basically presence and absence of these things, you know, if something doesn't have these things, it's not the Mahavakya. That would be Gati Reka like.
Well, that makes sense.
And Anvaya would mean if it does.
So it's the comparison of. So I'm going to say this should be explained in the commentary. I should say something about this. The comparison is between the presence and absence, or absence of these signs. Okay, what about Gati Samanya? Equivalence of meaning, or what is that? I mean, he's given an equivalence of meaning by giving losses, but that's not what we're talking about. I made a thing you should not do in translating. I translated the words, it makes sense, but I don't know the relevance of it. That means that I haven't done a proper job. You know, I can't just, in a very technical philosophical text, I can't just translate the words if I don't understand what they mean and what their relevance is. That means I probably don't really understand what the sentence really means, even though I know the words and I can put them together into a translation. I've got to be able to understand the relevance of it and make the reader understand it. And how can I make the reader understand the relevance if I don't know what it is? I just translate the words, throw something together, and move on. Well, the reader's not going, it's not going to help the reader very much. He'll see a coherent sentence, but he won't know what's the use of it, what's the relevance of it. If I don't know the relevance, and I don't know the relevance of this sentence, and therefore I have no right to translate it until I figure it out. Okay. Don't do this when you're translating. Just throw the words together. You don't know really what it means in the sense of what. So what? What's the purpose of it? What's the relevance of it? If you don't know that, then you haven't. You don't know enough to actually translate the sentence. Yes.
My suggestion of by equivalence of meaning, what I understand from this, according to the context, is
yes.
That, like you had. You use these different signs to see what is the Mahavakya? Okay, if I look at beginning conclusion, I may think the Mahavakya is this. Then if I look at repetition, I may think the Mahavakya is this. Then, and then the fact of knowing unknown. So you see if there's like a common thread.
Yes.
So if something is being repeated often, if it's at the beginning and if it's an unknown fact, then it might be the equivalence of meaning. So,
How's that equivalence of meaning?
That.
I mean, you're finding examples. You're looking at the text, and you're finding cases of actual. You're actually identifying, the signs in certain places. What kind of equivalence of meaning is that?
The meaning of a Mahavakya is understood by using these signs to identify the meaning of a Mahavakya.
Well, that's the identifying of the meaning of the Mahavakya. But where's the Samanya come in? Sameness.
So there's, once you've defined the meaning by using these signs, you have an equivalence of meaning, because using the different signs, you have come with the meaning of the Mahavakya.
But there's no equalness there. I don't see where that's gati samanya. That's finding the meaning, but where's the equalness? What's equal to what?
Well, you find the meaning by using one sign, then you find the meaning by using another sign.
Sometimes you do. Sometimes you can only find one sign.
Yeah, but if you find many, then you see, okay, are they all saying the same thing?
Could be. Yeah. Could be. Yeah, so you're saying that refers to when you have more than one sign show up, and they all point to the same thing. Could be. Yes? Yeah.
Goswami Prabhu shows how each of them shows that the Bhagavatam speaks about bhakti.
Okay, so you got a case of all six signs.
I guess.
And they all come up. They all come up with the same topic. They all point to the same topic.
That's
equivalence of meaning. Okay.
Yeah.
So okay. So can I write that down? I accept that. Gati Samanya means that more than one sign point to the same topic. Okay, I just need to say that coherently in the commentary, and then I think we're okay. Thank you. I'm satisfied with that. Any other questions about our six signs? He doesn't say much about it here. More is said in the Mimamsa Shastras. You can read the Arta Sangraha of Lao Gakshi Bhaskara, which I think is not in the library anymore. It's missing. We used to have a copy. Do we have it? We have scanned it. Okay, it's a useful book for explaining the basics of Mimamsa technology. You can find out more about these six signs and their application there. Jiva Goswami just gives this much, and then later on the Sandarbhas, he goes ahead and uses them a few times. A few times. Usually in the grand summary of a whole Sandarbha. Yes, okay, so I'm sorry, who...
About the six signs, it doesn't always happen that just by one sign, you can really arrive at the... really arrive at what's the topic of focus of the Mahavakya. So it could be a case that you consider all of them, like the beginning and the end and the Arthavada and all that, and then you understand the topic in such a way that one thing is it's not contradicted by any of the six signs, such that you get a consensus of all the six signs. Like, for example, Balde Vidya Bhushan shows one example in Vedanta Sutra Bhashya when he's explaining this Dvasaparna verse.
Yes.
He's explaining this same thing.
Yes.
How to apply this. And he applies this. Yeah, it was on Dvasaparna verse. And he shows, takes the first word, the second word.
Yes.
Samane Vrikshe Purusha. Like that. it was not that just with one sign you could get what's the topic of focus.
Sometimes you could. Or sometimes it's all the evidence you have and you have to be satisfied with just one sign. But usually not.
So gati samanya could also mean that that the meaning, of course, after you get
well, the meaning of the sign. I mean, the sign will indicate that such and such is the topic, and then you get the other sign, and it's also indicating the same topic.
Yeah, but
that's gati saman, you know.
Yeah. And one sign may not be able to indicate the topic fully, clearly, that you can be sure.
Right.
And once when you use all the signs to get the topic, then you are sure about what's the topic. And then if you go back and see one sign, what it's saying, like dwa, yes, and then this, and then it's clear for you. Oh,
I think you might also have a case where one of the signs points in another direction, and you have to decide priority, that upakrama and upasamhara get priority. And if there's a contradictory sign, you disregard that one. But also, if one sign points in the wrong direction, but four of them point in the right direction, in the same direction, that's gati samanya. And that would be evidence also. That you don't have to worry about one of them pointing in the wrong direction if several of them point in the same direction. I'm not that familiar with the actual usage of this by the Mimamsakas and Vaishnavacharyas. You know, if we were more familiar with how these are actually used, then we maybe it would be easier to answer these questions.
Some time ago, I was trying to understand the use properly. So the only reference I found where an acharya is demonstrating its usage was in this Vedanta Sutra.
The Vedanta Sutra,
Baladev Vidyabhushan is showing us.
In the Vedanta Sutra itself, 1.1.12, Anandamayo Abhyasat. That's actually referring to that linga. That in the long passage, it's a long passage in the Taittiriya Upanishad talking about the five koshas, the anamoy, manomoy, pranamoy, manomoy, vijnanamoy, and andamoy. So, is anandamaya the absolute truth, or is it the jiva, or something else? There's a doubt. And the sutra says, no, anandamaya is Brahman, abhyasat, because of repetition. Because Brahman is identified as the topic of that whole passage more than one place, several places in that passage. Therefore, when we get to the end, and the anandamaya is described as the final self, and there's no self of that self, you know, it's not subordinated to any other self. So that anandamaya must be Brahman, because Brahman is repeatedly identified as the topic of that whole passage. In that passage, Brahman is mentioned as the topic many, many times. Anyway, that's explained in the Govinda Bhasha. So this is abhyasa, the repetition in the passage to indicate the prime topic. And it's used in the Vedanta Sutra itself. Okay, that means this terminology goes back at least 5,000 years then. It goes back to when Vyasadeva wrote his Vedanta Sutra and before. Okay, shall we move on? Yatra tu vakyantarena viroda syat tatra bala balatvam vivechaniyam tatcha shastragatam vachanagatam cha. Now we're another technology from the Mimamsa, another system for determining meaning. This is not determining the overall meaning of a passage, but in a shastra, when you have two apparently contradictory statements, what do you do about it? How do you reconcile? So there are six signs. Or six, anyway, let's read on. There's six principles on the basis of which you decide what the actual meaning is when there's apparent contradiction. Yes, it's just elliptical. It's just leaving out the second is. But you can do that. Which is stronger and which weaker? It's fine. You don't have to say is again. Okay, let's read this. Yatra tu vakyantarena virodaksya tatra balabalatvam vivechaniyam tatra shastragatam vachanagatam cha. But when there are conflicting statements, we must decide which is stronger and which is weaker. This relative strength and weakness applies to differences between one scripture and another, as well as to different statements within a single scripture. Okay. In the same Upanishad, it may say Brahman has no qualities. And then another statement is actually listing the qualities in the same Upanishad. So what do we do about that? Which one of them is more literal to be taken? They both have to be in the Shastra, especially in the Shruti, all the statements have to be accepted as authoritative. But the stronger one should be taken literally, and the weaker one should be modified in some figurative sense. Okay? Just like statements, okay, among all the Upanishads, there are statements in different Shastras. There are some statements that say there's no difference. Absolute truth is one without any distinction. In other places, it says that the absolute truth has distinction within it. So, there are statements that the absolute truth cannot be described by words. And then there are statements that in words describe the absolute truth. So which is to be taken literal, and which has to be understood figuratively? We have to apply these principles that we're going to be given in order to decide, to reconcile the apparent contradiction. There can't be any actual contradiction within the Vedas, between one book and another or inside the same book. You may have non-Vedic texts, unauthorized texts, and we can have actual contradiction with them because they're wrong. But within the Shastra, the Vedas Shastra, there shouldn't be any real contradiction. And the apparent contradiction has to be decided by deciding which one should be taken more literally, which one is stronger in that sense, and which one has to be understood in some modified way. Like, we take the statement that the absolute truth has qualities and the description of those qualities as literal. And the statement that he has no qualities or can't be described by words, we say he doesn't have any material qualities. He can't be described by material words. We add the word material to modify it. We assume as implied the idea of material words, material understanding. So the statement that he has qualities should be taken more literally, and the statement that he has no qualities should be understood figuratively. So the statement that he has qualities is stronger. Purvam yata Shruti smriti virode tu Shruti eva baliyasi Ityadi Uttaram chayata Shruti linga vakya prakarana stana samakyanam samavaye para daurbalyam Ityadi. Okay. We have two applications. One between different scriptures, and the other is inside the same scripture. Apparent contradiction. The rule for the first type of application, which means among different scriptures. Here's a mistake. This is not the basic rule. This is an example. Mistake in the translation. The rule for the first type of application. I should say instead, an example of the first type of application. In a conflict between Shruti and Smriti, the Shruti is stronger. Any problem with that? Two different scriptures, Smriti and Shruti, but the Shruti has precedence if there's an apparent contradiction. And then, example of the second. An example of apparent contradiction, what to do about apparent contradiction inside the same scripture. When direct statement, logical indication, the sentence, the larger context, the location, and the etymology concur. The later items are progressively weaker because they are derived by progressively more indirect methods. Concur is confusing. I think what I meant by concur is occur together, but concur means to agree also. If they all agree, then we don't have any apparent contradiction. We're talking about an apparent contradiction where they don't seem to agree. So, concur is misleading. I'm making a note. Well, occur together is what I mean. But I don't mean that they all agree with one another. That, if that was the case, we'd have nothing to worry about, nothing to think about. There'd be no apparent contradiction. What are these things? There's six different kinds of signs. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But they're not the same signs that we were talking about before, different ones. So they also have to be defined. And that's done right now. There's a verse. I don't have a reference for it. I don't know where it comes from. But anyway, it's Shruti Shabdat Shamata Chalingam. Vakyam padani evatu samhatani sa prakriya yat karanam sakangsham snanam kramo yogabalam samakya. That's actually six definitions packed into one verse. Okay, it's a little concise. I think we need some further explanation in the commentary. I hope there is some. Anyway, it says, these terms are thus defined. And now the translation of that verse. Direct statement. That's the term, and it means direct statement is okay. And they originally applied these six criteria to the analysis of sacrificial rituals, because Mimamsa was written to analyze Vedic sacrifices. Shruti, direct statement, is the directly perceived meaning of a word or statement. When it is clear and unambiguous, there is no need to resort to the other criteria. Linga, logical indication, is the conventional meaning of a word whose meaning is not at once obvious. For example, now I give actual Mimamsa examples of using these lingas. I'm sorry, they're not lingas, they're criteria, whatever. Because this one is called linga, the second one. Logical indication. For example, there is a statement in the Vedas describing the ritual for preparing sacred kusha grass. By here, Devasadanam Dami, I cut the grass, the seat of the gods. Etymologically, the word barhyas could refer to various types of grass, but the conventional usage is that it refers only to kusha grass. Dictionary will tell you barhi can refer to different types of grass. That's okay, but I want to do a sacrifice. I got to know which is the right grass. I'm not just talking theoretically. I have to do it. So I need to know which grass to cut. So the Mimamsa, the linga, logical indication, how does that work? To resolve this ambiguity, one must first use the linga pramana. These are called pramanas, evidence, which specifies this conventional usage. To derive this statement from this statement an injunction, since for the Mimamsakas, the only ultimately meaningful statements are injunctions, a second step is required. The presumption of such an unspoken statement as, the cutting of kusha should be done with this mantra. Because the statement, I cut the grass, the seed of the gods, is just a mantra. It doesn't state any injunction. You have to assume an implied injunction. And I'm applying the principle of linga, of logical indication, namely that kusha here refers conventionally, I mean, barhis refers conventionally to particularly kusha grass. And so I assume that there's an implied injunction. You should cut this kusha grass using this mantra. That's the injunction. Although it's not spoken, it's implied. So when I, to use linga, I have to add a second step. I have to assume an implied injunction. Therefore, just using shruti, the obvious meaning of a statement is stronger. It doesn't require any extra steps or any presumptions. It's more direct, therefore it's stronger. So shruti is stronger than linga. Continuing, because applying linga requires an extra step to arrive at a specific injunction, it is less direct and so will be overruled by a directly perceived meaning, shruti, if one is available. The problem is we have an ambiguity. We don't know for sure what barhi means. Therefore, we have to think about it and assume an injunction and assume the conventional meaning. For example, there is an injunction, Aindriya Garhapatyam Upatishteta. With the mantra for Indra, one should honor the Garhapatya fire. By linga, conventional usage, the word Aindriya would suggest that this sentence enjoins that Indra should be honored. This is overruled, however, by the direct sense of the injunction, that the fire, instead, is meant to be honored. Because it says, Garhapatya Upatishteta, you should worship the Garhapatya fire. It doesn't say worship Indra here, it says worship the fire. So even though the term Aindriya seems to indicate worship of Indra, mantra meant for Indra, here the direct statement overrules that. The direct obvious meaning of the statement. It obviously says we're supposed to worship the fire. So you don't apply linga here because it's overruled by shruti. That makes sense? By similar reasoning, the other pramanas listed in this verse are progressively still weaker because they are even more indirect, each requiring an extra step to arrive at a presumed shruti. That means this third one requires two steps extra, and the fourth one requires three extra steps, and so on. I'm going to chain and to another. Can I make a note of this? Hold on a second. Check with... Wait a second. Yes, what's your question? I'm changing each requiring an extra step to each requiring another extra step. Because it's not that each one of them requires only one step. The second one requires one step, the third one requires two steps, the fourth one requires three steps. So I don't want to just mean that each one requires one step. So that, I think another makes it clearer. Anyway, that's actually shown in the rest of the commentary. An example of Vakya's, Vakya's the third praman, being overruled by linga, the second praman, can be found in the pair of statements, Sionam te sadanam krinomi, and Gritasya daraya susheivam kalpayami. And then another sentence, Tasmin sida amrite pratishta vrihinam medha sumana siyama manaha. These are supposedly statements from Shruti, but I don't know where they come from. And it's addressed to the rice cake, to the purodasha that you're going to offer. Yes, I did. Vakyam, let me go back to the skipped over paragraph. Vakya, the sentence, vakya means sentence, right? Refers in this context to the syntactic linkage between words spoken together. So when we say vakya, technically it really means the syntax of the sentence. For example, somewhere in the Shruti it is said, Yasya parnamayi juhur bhavati asa papam shlokam. There was an N missing. Na sa papam shlokam shrinoti. One who has a juhu ladle made of palasha wood will never be reviled. Okay? Give me one of those? Okay. The simple fact that the adjective parnamayi is in grammatical agreement with the noun juhu
Well, okay, there's a grammatical syntax there, is anvaya. Indicates by vakya pramana that being made of this kind of wood alone serves the purpose of the ladle. Although the ladle could be made of other wood, although a ladle made of other wood could do the job physically, the transcendental benefit of the sacrifice is accomplished only by using a parnama yijuhu. Okay, that's known by vakya, by the fact that parnamayi is the adjective of juhu. So it's got to be that kind of juhu. Yes, Prabhu? Ladle, yeah. Well, you don't like that word? It's well, juhu is the name of a big spoon that you use to pour the ghee. Parna is a kind of wood. It's a tree. Particular tree. Palasha tree. It's called parna. Yes. So it's not a plastic ladle or aluminum ladle. It's a parnamayi ladle. Yes.
Yeah.
It's not a soup spoon. It's a flat spoon for ghee. Yes.
I'm a little confused about this linga here.
Linga. Oh,
because,
boy.
In one place we're saying it's logical indication.
Yes.
And another place we're saying it's capability.
It's what?
Capability. It was defined as kshamata.
I'm afraid that the gloss said that, right? Kshamata cha lingam is what that verse said.
Yeah. And then in the paragraph beginning...
Where do I say capability?
I think you didn't say it, but you say conventional usage.
Okay. So I guess I have to... Where do I say conventional usage?
In that...
second paragraph.
Yeah, Aindra Gahapati.
Okay, so I have to say it... I have to explain that conventional usage is capability.
Capability.
I have to show how it actually is capability. I don't know right offhand, but I have to do that. Write another sentence or two into the commentary to explain that.
I'm not sure I get the logic also. Maybe you could explain it.
Yes.
Is that, okay, we have this statement, Bahir Deva Sadanam Dami, I cut the grass, the seed of the gods.
Yes.
And then by logical indication, we're supposed to know that Bahi means Kusha.
Well, that logical indication is just the recognition of the conventional meaning, that there is a conventional meaning.
That by convention, Bahi usually means Kusha.
Yeah. Now how that linga comes out to be conventional meaning, I have to clarify that.
Right, yeah.
To do that, I have to understand it. Okay. I can't sit down and explain it right now because I don't understand it.
Okay, sure. Yeah, conventional meaning makes sense, but it's just...
Yeah, conventional meaning fits, but how is that linga and how is that what I translated as capability? Doesn't seem to match. I'll try to make it match. I'll try to figure out how it's the same thing. It was hard enough to get this much of it together.
It's very, very difficult stuff.
It's stuff that I'm not really familiar with. Okay, we go back to the linga, the vakya for now? An example of vakyas being overruled by linga can be found in the statements, a pair of statements, those statements, translated, O rice cakes, I am preparing a nice seat for you, and with a flow of ghee, I am making it agreeable for your use. O cream of the rice grains, please sit on it with a composed mind and remain fixed on this immortal seat. Okay, now, explanation. These are two separate sentences, but their ideas are connected by the pronoun tasmin, right? Because it refers back to the seat that was described in the first sentence. I'm making her a nice seat, I'm pouring ghee on it, please sit down on it. Tasmin. So there's a connection. Tasmin, by antecedent, refers back to the first sentence. That's syntax. From the conventional meaning of the words involved, we can tell that the first sentence is meant for the ritual of preparing a seat for the rice cake, and the second is meant for the ritual of inviting the rice cake to take the seat. Those are two different rituals.
two different sub-rituals. Although Vakya Pramana tries to tell us on the contrary, that these two sentences, as a combined sentence, are both meant to be used in either of these rituals, the Vakya is overruled by Linga. Linga comes first, it only involves one extra step. Vakya involves two extra steps. So Vakya is weaker. The Vakya seems to tell us that there's only one injunction here. Not injunction, there's one ritual being talked about. But actually, even though the two sentences come right one after another, they're actually talking about two different rituals. Even though it seems to be, by syntax, it seems to be a coherent statement, well, one statement following directly from another. Here's a nice seat, I poured ghee on it, please sit down on it. Seems to be one story here. But actually, by the stronger praman of linga, of the conventional meanings of the words, it's actually referring to two different rituals. And you have to apply them separately. You don't use either or both for either or both rituals. You have to use one for one ritual and the second one for the second ritual. I know we don't care. We're not interested in all this ritual stuff, but this is where this terminology first came. What does it have to do with the conventional meaning of the words? Okay, I mean, you know, sadhanam. Sadhanam can mean a house. But when you're talking to rice cakes, you're not building them a house out of bricks. You're making a seat with kusha grass. You know, and so you understand that in context, the conventional meaning of sadhanam there is the seat made out of kusha grass that you're going to put the rice cakes on. You're not going to put them on a plastic tray or build a house out of bricks. You're going to put kusha grass and call it a seat and chant some mantras to make it a seat. These are the mantras you use to make the grass a seat. So that's the purpose of this first sentence, according to the conventional meaning of the word sadhanam. And in the second sentence, well, you've got sita, please sit down, you know, and so on. That's obviously talking by what the word siddha is understood to mean. It means you're telling somebody to sit down. So the purpose of the second injunction is to invite the rice cake to take the seat. It's the mantra used in the ritual. You have to know. You have to be able to figure out which mantras to use in which rituals. Because the Vedas themselves don't have footnotes telling you. Or there's no headings in the Vedas. Which mantras get used where in the sacrifices. You have to figure that all out. There are books by the various sages, the sutras, Shrauta sutras and so on, that tell you which mantras to use. But they're not complete. They just give some indication of which mantras to use. You've got to extend that information by using the Mimamsa principles to to be very exact about which mantras go where, in which rituals, and when they're used. Okay. It may be that these words come right out of the Yajurveda. It sounds like Yajurveda. And then they're explained in the Griya Sutra, in the Shrota Sutras, when you use them. But the explanation is not complete, therefore it has to be filled in with applying Mimamsa principles to make sure you know when to use which mantra.
Just a simple question about the rice cakes. Do we know what they are? Are they like an idli or are they like
something like that? I've seen, at least in the Shraddha ceremony done by a Vaishnava, I've seen it is pretty much an idli. But maybe he didn't really know what a... I think you can find the recipe for Purodasha somewhere. And it probably is something very similar to an idli. Yeah. Bigger. Yeah.
Nijan who had first...
The fact that Vakya is overruled by Linga is because, I didn't catch the point.
Why is it overruled? Yeah. Because Linga is the ones that come earlier on the list of six are stronger because they're more direct. All every next one on the list requires an extra step of implication.
But
you know, you have to
example,
imply an extra statement.
How it happens here, but in this particular example.
Well, I didn't bother to show that. There should be two steps involved. Well, because the vakya has to imply a linga, and the linga has to imply a shruti. That's the way it works. You have to work back up the chain. There has to be the syntax will imply a certain conventional usage, and then that conventional usage will imply an unspoken injunction. And that's also explained in the Mimamsa Shastras, how each one of these lingas involve more and more extra steps. I just don't remember all of it, and I didn't put it into the commentary. Sorry. Yeah. It's there, though. If you get a hold of this book, we have the scanned copy, Artha Samgraha. You can find it there. Yes. I'm sorry, but Vishnu Khan had his hand.
It's there.
Okay.
But you do explain how linga is in this.
Linga, actually, but I explained how linga involves one extra step, but I didn't do that. I just mentioned that each of the other ones requires another step.
But you,
I didn't show that.
You mentioned in this example how
of what for linga?
From the conventional meanings of the world words.
I do that for linga, but I don't do that for the other ones.
Okay.
For vakya, I don't show how it involves two steps.
Yeah, but that's. I mean, when I read that, I understood like that. From the conventional meanings of the words, which is linga involved, we can tell that the first sentence is meant for the ritual of preparing a seat for the rice cake, and the second is meant for the ritual of inventing the rice cake to take the seat.
Yes.
That's linga. By linga, you say, okay, this sentence.
Okay, and then linga. And then okay, so we need one one, you know, step of thinking to get to linga, and then we already know that linga you have to imply an injunction, so you need another step. So there's two steps. One step to get to linga, and the other step to get from linga to shruti. You always have to end up in a natural injunction. Otherwise, the whole idea is, of the Imams, is to figure out what are we supposed to do. We're sitting here, we don't know what to do. Yeah, we don't know how to do the yajna. So what we want, give us an injunction. That's what we want. So we have to get to the shruti, to the actual injunction. So here we have to use two steps to get it, because we're describing using one step, an extra step, to get from vakya to linga. We already described how you need an extra step to get from linga to shruti. So that makes two steps.
But you, in this example of vakya, you do explain this without getting into details, but you say, like, from the conventional meanings of the words involved, which is linga,
yeah,
we can tell that the first sentence is meant for the rituals.
Yeah. That there's an injunction.
It meant for the ritual of preparing a seat of the rice cake, and the second is meant for the ritual of inviting the rice cake to take the seat.
And we know that it's meant by assuming that there's an injunction.
Yeah.
So we just presume an injunction. That's the second step.
And then you bring in the
vakya. I don't say that. But,
you don't say that, yeah. And then you bring in the vakya by saying that, okay, now the extra steps that's taken is that you take these two statements and actually it's just one, because of the word tasmin.
Right, but that's overruled.
Sentence.
That's overruled.
So
the vakya praman is overruled by the linga. Yeah. Because the linga is more direct.
No, the linga overrules.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the vakya would tell you there's only one statement. The linga says there's two different statements. The linga wins because it's more direct. It only involves one extra step. Vakya is more indirect because it involves two extra steps. We got to stop now. We'll have to continue tomorrow. Anyway, I think I left that out because I thought it was enough mind-boggling what we had here. I didn't want to add more. Just to spare the reader, I left out all this detailed explanation of how there are extra steps. Okay, we stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Sri Tattva Sandarbha Ki Jai.